Okay, here we are with another edition of Old School Guns, the podcast that has the opinion, the news, and the questions that you want answered, and we answer them. As always, we are unsponsored, we are unbeholding and unfettered, and so we kind of tell you how it is, and when what we say is strictly our own opinion, and be that as it may. Well, we're going to jump right into this, and the first thing that kind of caught our attention is Hillary Clinton bashes the 4th of July celebration in Washington, D.C. And you know, a couple of podcasts ago, we kind of did our open letter or our open statement to Clinton, and basically this is just more of her sour grapes, but it's also a fact that, you know, she's not a good loser. She absolutely has no graciousness, not a smidgen of it, not a little bit in her little finger. She's ungracious, a sorehead, a poor loser, and she even rags on patriotism and downplays the military of this country just to demonstrate her sour grapes. She should be ashamed of herself. I mean, no former presidential candidate has really reacted in that manner. And, you know, she would be best served by riding off into the sunset. And, you know, she was the first woman to run for president. No one could ever take that away from her. Her political career, which was launched simply by her marriage to Bill Clinton, was really, for the most part, an abject failure. Lost two rounds of the presidency. She won, I think, two elections to the New York Senate, something the Democratic machine gave her. And she was a very lackluster Secretary of State and the crowning blow in all that was the Benghazi disaster, where, you know, not only could she not answer the call at 3 a.m, she couldn't make a decision. She left people out to hang, just out to dry. And then she lied to the families about the reasons that this all happened. And then she lied about their responses just to cover her own smelly backside. A disgusting, despicable human being. The next one is a little bit better news. And that is, you know, the 50th anniversary of the moon landing is coming up, and you know, Apollo 11 captured the imagination of a generation. It you know, it really helped kind of repair the country and kind of restore a national focus after the very, very turbulent 1960s. The moon landing was a success that everybody could kind of look at and shake their head and say, yeah, this is a good thing. It was an apolitical, started by Kennedy and obviously carried on by Johnson and finished by Nixon, kind of an apolitical achievement that everybody could look at and feel good about. And, you know, the wondrous technology that came out of it, you know, and everyone had Tang, or they had these terrible little sticks of, there's some kind of protein stick, and they were these little brown sticks that came individually wrapped. You'd eat those, some sort of moon snack. Whether the actual astronauts ate those or not, I tend to doubt. But, you know, it was definitely a great time, and everyone thought that it was really the first step in a lot of great things to come. Unfortunately, as it turned out, it didn't really work out that way. What we really didn't understand as a nation was it was the absolute extension of technology and absolute risk-taking that our country took to get to the moon and back safely. And all the ones except Apollo 13 were able to do that. And even it got back safely. Never got there, but it got back safely. That was our technological limit, and that was about the most risk we were willing to take. And NASA has been very risk-averse since. And it's never really achieved anything that great afterwards. We had Skylab, which was just, you know, a big can floating around in space. I've had the shuttle program, which was the shuttle was supposed to be the DC-3 of outer space, the airplane that, you know, made it all normal the way the DC-3 did with air travel. The shuttle was supposed to do a space flight, and it came up woefully short. The space shuttle turned out to be a labor-intensive, dangerous piece of equipment, and in fact two of them exploded, and they only got it back on after the second, after the Columbia explosion. They only got the program back on track so that they could save face and then just kind of shut it down. And since it's been shut down, shoot, I don't even think we can resupply. As a government, we can't even resupply the International Space Station, which is up there, which is a bunch of cans bolted together and floating around up there. I think they have to get private companies like SpaceX or even collude with the Russians. We have to collude with the Russians to get them to shoot food and stuff up there into space. So, and I think actually the emergency escape capsule, in case something really went south, in case something really went wrong on the space station, I think even the emergency capsule is a Soyuz capsule that kind of sits there. And so if the thing started to break up or something really bad happened, everybody scoots down to the Soyuz capsule, gets in it, and they land in the middle of Kazakhstan or someplace like that, you know. So that's kind of what it is. And I saw that with the an article that was talking about the moon landings. I said, well, what's next? And now they're thinking about making another space station. This one will float around the moon, though. And I guess the deal is you'd fly to a space station that circles the Earth, and then get on, stay there for a while, then get on another one that flies around, get on another rocket that flies to this other space station. And then from there, you can kind of get a lander, go down on the moon. And, you know, there's a lot more rocks we can pick up on the moon. I'm sure there's, you know, a lot more stuff they can do. It always seemed to me they were always trying to grow asparagus or something else on the space station. Now I guess they can go try to grow some on the moon, and they'll look around and see if there's any ice there, or, you know, whatever it is they want to do on the moon. My impression is the moon's just a great big old rock that's floating around out there, and I don't really know why we want to be on it. And it just seems to me that the space travel and just being up there to be up there, it's just something we just can't afford as a nation, and even the world can't afford it. You know, it's you look at that, and are we going to explore something that we know is a vacant wasteland that has no real practical use? So it'll be really interesting to see where this goes, and if they could even make this ambitious lunar plan happen. Frankly, when the original moon landings happened, everybody thought that within the next 5 or 10 years we would be doing this, and it never came about. And part of the reason was the expenses. And I even think the last, and I don't know this, you can leave it in comments if you actually know the answer, wasn't it the last 2, 3, or 4 Apollo missions basically scrapped because they said, look, you know, we already got the moon rocks, man. We already got all the rocks we need, so we don't need to spend billions more. I mean, I think by the pound, moon rocks are something that you would pave your driveway in gold before you would use moon rocks for anything. I think they're absolutely the most expensive piece of mineral anywhere because of what it takes to get them. So we got all the moon rocks we need, and I guess if we need more, we can go up there and scoop some up. But it'll be interesting to see how this all develops. In Second Amendment news, Governor Northam, Mr. Blackface, and all the other bad things that he is and was and is continuing to do, is having some special session on gun control. If you are a Virginia person, Please just do whatever you can to stop this. Badger your legislators, protest, whatever you need to do to stop these guys from doing this. This is clearly a deflection from his political problems and his past catching up with him. And the same thing with his lieutenant governor, another real creep. So anyway, it's gun control is nothing. They're using it as a deflection. And I think that's absolutely wrong. They need to be held accountable for the stuff they're doing wrong and solve those problems. Okay, a couple other little tidbits up there. This really isn't Second Amendment. It's just more general gun culture stuff. I was just looking, of course, one of my favorite things is the Thompson submachine gun. It's, you know, to me, the iconic image of the Thompson, the history of the 1930s and 20s and 30s, and the, you know, kind of its culmination in World War II as a useful, very useful weapon for the Allies. So I've always been fascinated with them, and I've always liked them, admired them. I thought they had just the greatest look, you know, the whole thing. So I saw this Forgotten Weapons video where, and it's probably a couple years old, where they dig up old Ken Hackathorn, kind of one of the older gun writers, kind of a Cooperite, maybe even a Soldier of Fortune type guy. And, you know, of course, he's kind of throwing shade on it. And I'm just sitting there going, you know, this is kind of ridiculous. The Thompson's a 100-year-old design now. I mean, of course, everything that came after it has some level of improvement, or else it wouldn't be there. It just wouldn't be there. And sometimes you have to accept things for what they are. I think what I got from the video was that it because of its media attention and exposure and use in the movies and whatnot, that it has a reputation that's undeserved, and its performance doesn't match up to the reputation. And, you know, this is all pablum. You could say the same thing about the 1903 Springfield. You can say the same thing about any weapon. And in fact, the in-range TV guys even talk about that with the STG-44. And I would sit there and I would opine that, yes, the STG-44 has weaknesses compared to modern military rifles, but it was kind of the first one. So kind of like another one they throw shade on, the C-96 Mauser. And my point on that is, well, when that was designed, nobody really knew what an auto pistol was supposed to look like. So they designed function, and it looked how it looked. And it does have this what has become an iconic appearance. But when you look at it compared to other guns, it's really pretty wonky and very strange. So it's just one of those things. You have to sometimes accept a weapon for what it is, and not what everything else is and how does it compare. That's one of the reasons this endeavor is called Old School Guns. There's a lot to appreciate about older designs and old school guns. There just is. The other thing about Hackathorn is I kind of looked up his bio because I thought, you know, I've always heard a lot about this guy, but I've never really knew that much about him. And, you know, I just saw his name as a byline in gun magazines. And I don't know what his background really is. His bio is very vague. It says Special Forces Weapons Instructor. Now, whether that means he is a U.S. Army veteran of Special Forces and he was a weapons instructor there, or if he was somehow a weapons instructor for other Special Forces for other countries as a contractor, or if he was a U.S. If he taught U.S. Special Forces as a contractor. I really can't tell. I can't really see a military or law enforcement background. If you know what it is, again, leave it in the comment, because his bio is very vague. And I just wanted to know, you know, are you, when you use the word Special Forces now, were you in it? Were you associated with it, attached to it? What is your exact association, so that we know that there's not some misrepresentation going on? But we'll see. I watched about 3/4 of the video, and then I just couldn't stand it anymore, so I turned it off. Which brings me to the next amazing thing I saw, and this was InRange TV, the kind of the partner network. They had this guy on there. I think his name is James Reeves or something like that. he's basically a guy from the Firearms Blog TV. He's a producer. He's apparently an attorney and a few other things. You know, and I've kind of seen some of his content. And you know, it's not bad. It's not bad. Some of his articles are interesting. Mostly focused on modern things. But so, you know, some of it's of interest to me and some of it is not. But what kind of got me with this question and answer, and it's like three segments of it, is, you know, first of all, never let anybody film you when you're drinking, because you look like an ass. You look like a complete ass. And don't let a guy like Carl Carsada or somebody else kind of sit there and be the sober guy. And then he had this guy Reeves and another guy called Olam, Deviant Olam, whose name is Deviant. Is that how he pronounces it? I don't know. But and this guy was a techie guy. And, you know, some of their stuff kind of got into this tech world stuff, which, you know, I understand it. There's people interested in that. When I watch some firearms related content, I don't really care about the Microsoft cloud or any of the rest of this. Just don't really care. Want to hear about guns. And I'd also say that, you know, don't drink and, just like they say, don't drink and drive. Don't drink and try to opine, because you just look stupid. And they put a bunch of F-bombs out there. They put a few other things. Now, to their credit, they did have a warning on there, hey, adult language. That doesn't really bother me, but I just thought it was low rent. Dude sitting around drinking and trying to answer questions. And even the answers started to get really wonky after a while. I mean, I thought the discussion on the 300 blackout was just absolutely inane. You know, I'm not impressed with the 300 blackout. I think that a lot of these AR cartridges are just a good idea. An answer looking for a good idea, maybe, I don't know, or a good idea looking for a question. It's whenever you go away from 5.56 in an AR platform, the standard AR platform, I think that you tread into a place where all of a sudden your gun is becoming a lot more specialized, and your ammo cost is going to significantly increase, and is your performance really going to increase? So I don't know. People have to look at that. 300 blackout I see as being ludicrous, just simply because it's a low powered cartridge, limited range. Its only possible use would be in suppressed versions, and really, are you even going to use an AR for that? Do you really want the clack of the bolt and the mechanism? And there's no real way to stop that. So maybe a suppressed bolt gun would be a much better answer if you're looking for that type of an application. And there is a lot of application for that in places that are noise sensitive, where you have to remove predators near occupied dwellings or some other type of thing. Basically, a suppressed 300 blackout would be a good option for some of that. But to sit there and opine that it makes the 7.62 by 39 obsolete was, you know, it just wasn't sound reasoning, because that's a cartridge designed for an entirely different purpose, a purpose that could not be replaced by the 300 blackout, even if you want to try to draw similarities in performance. The 7.62 by 39 is a creature that is, it is codependent with the AK rifle, and they're not going to stop making AK rifles in 7.62 by 39 to jump to 300 blackout. So it in effect is something totally different, and that's a worthless comparison. I would not. I felt that it was a three-part series where they took obviously about 90 minutes worth of content, broke it into three 30-minute and change segments, and it was very disappointing. You know, watching guys flipping beer bottles around and all the rest of this, it gave me the impression that these guys are trying to be cool, and they're not cool. You know, these are the uncool guys trying to be cool, and they're trying to be firearms cool. And, you know, it's kind of a joke. I mean, I would not expect to see that kind of a venue and see that kind of a setting with tier one operators. And you look, and all these tier one operators are guys who've actually done, you know, high risk operations. They don't act that way. You don't see a Larry Vickers act that way. You don't see even Chris Peronto, you know, the guy from Benghazi, one of the Benghazi guys. You don't see them act that way. They might be pretty outspoken, but you wouldn't see what you just saw on InRange TV. And if that was an experiment, my input to them would be, it's a poor experiment. The experiment had a very poor outcome, so I hope we don't see that again. Here's my favorite part of the podcast, the questions and answers. And I got a few of them here today, so they're kind of related to some of the some earlier stuff we've talked about. So let's go right into it. Did you see the AMC series The Sun, and it featured the 351 Winchester? What do you know about this gun and caliber? Well, the 351 Winchester survived only in one gun that was ever designed for it, the 1907 Winchester. They call it a rifle, but it was really more of a carbine. And it's a unique design. It came essentially in three different iterations. The first one was the 1905, had a weak 32 and a weak 35 cartridge. Was not a big hit, just didn't have enough power. In 1907, they modified the design. It came out with a 351, which launches a 180-grain bullet at just about 2,000 feet per second. Then a little later, they had a 401 Winchester, which launched a larger bullet, a little bit slower, but it was a good round. These were kind of delayed blowback sort of rifles. They weren't locked breech. So they were kind of operating at the upper end of what you can do with a blowback action. And they have a big counterweight that sits under the barrel, and that's connected to the bolt. And it takes a lot of energy to push the bolt and this big weight all the way back. It's definitely it's really an obsolete action by now. I mean, it's certainly well over a century year old, and but it was a pretty good idea for its time. I mean, at a time when you had lever action was as fast as you were going to go, this basically provided realistic center fire firepower and an intermediate cartridge. No pistol was ever chambered for the 351. And it's more powerful than the M1 carbine, so it's a true intermediate cartridge in many ways, even though it's straight-walled. And so, and it did came from the factory with a 5-round magazine for hunting, but 10-round magazines could be purchased, and I understand 15-rounders could, although I have never seen one, and I'm not sure of the fidelity of the pictures that are out there purporting to be of them. But I know the 10-rounders were very available, and you can still buy them today. Now, they'll cost you a pretty penny, something over $2 if you find them on GunBroker or eBay. But they're out there, and you can get them. The rifles themselves are, like everything else, they're kind of incrementally creeping up. Ammunition is very, very difficult to find. Loaded ammo is horrifically expensive. And cartridge cases are almost empty cases are almost unobtainium. The Jameson cartridge company or brass makers, Jameson anyway, they made a run about 2 years ago, and if you didn't buy that, you're probably hurting, because vintage ammo, which they really stopped loading in the late 60s, early 70s. Vintage ammo is very expensive, and the custom rolled stuff by custom loaders, really hard to get. But as far as loading it goes, it's not a bad cartridge. It's very forgiving. I have found that, you know, there's a lot of load data out there, and only Hodgdon IMR 4227 is worth anything. The rest of them, the load you see with Unique and all that, just didn't work in the two guns that I was working with. So you can take, your mileage may vary, but using the and I had to use plated bullets that I think they came from Graf's 351 or 352 plated lead bullets, and they worked out very well. You know, it's very, very good. You can get the gun shooting, and it's a good gun to shoot. Some people have touted this. Well, this was the first what we would call assault rifle, or what we would call as a semi, you know, kind of the equivalent of an AR-15. And of course, it's not. It's the magazine latch. While it looks very simple, it's kind of, you really have to squeeze it and pull to get the magazine out. And the good part is, though, a loaded magazine just kind of slaps up into place, but you got to have to be forceful with it. Does not have a bolt hold open, so you've got to cycle the bolt. And as the bolt handle or charging handle on the side of the receiver was still under patent to Browning at the time, you have to actually have a charging rod, which is under the barrel, and you reach forward, and it's got a little hand, little finger rest, and you pull that back and go. But it'll shoot 10 rounds very quickly, and it's because it's such a heavy gun with its counterweight, very controllable, and it was used up until the early 1970s by prison guards and other things. They were sold on the market. Nobody really wanted them. For years, they sold for peanuts. Now they're going up in price as people have seen the value of them, and as they've become a little more collectible. So definitely a very, very interesting gun. It was used on The Sun, which was, you know, a story on AMC about a kind of a Texas dynasty family there. The Sun was, he was captured, about a man who was captured by Comanches as a youth, raised by them, left them, came into the white civilized world, came back, was in the Confederate Army in the Civil War, and then became a large, prosperous rancher. But, you know, things being as they were, by the time 1915 rolls around, although he's still prosperous, his the finances are definitely becoming more and more difficult. He finds oil on a neighbor's property and proceeds to kill off the neighbors and seize the property through some chicanery, and it goes on and on and on. And there are action scenes, there are killings and other things like that, and you do see the 1907 Winchester in the first season of The Sun plays a very prominent role, and it's probably one of the few times you ever really see it on camera. The only other time was something we'll talk about a little bit later, the Highwayman, the movie that just came out on Netflix, and there's a couple of quick shots of one of the deputies holding a 1907 Winchester with an extended magazine. So 351 is a great cartridge. I think the only thing that is equivalent or similar to it these days is the this 350 Legend, which is coming out. And I'm given to understand that is probably ballistically superior. Both in velocity and perhaps in bullet type too. You can only use blunt, you know, kind of round nose blunt bullets in a 1907 Winchester. And of course, an AR has got a whole different feed mechanism, geometry, and much more versatile as far as the types of bullets that it can take in chambers. So we'll see how that works out. I'm hoping, and I do not know because I haven't really done the research, but I'm hoping that maybe 350 Legend Brass can be repurposed into 351 Winchester without doing some of the things that have to be done with other cartridges. So, we'll see how that goes. But the 351 is definitely a very cool round, very nostalgic. Yes, there are a lot of things that are ballistically better and a lot of things that are superior. Things, even the M1 carbine is really much easier to shoot and load for and everything else. You have to have a passion for that particular era in history, that 1900 to 1920 or 1930 era, to really want to use the Winchesters, the 351s, and even the other ones. The same thing with the other ones. They're pretty tough to get ammunition for and components. As a note, they were not widely used, but they were used in the First World War, first as aircraft armament, before they could, when airplanes were so crummy, they couldn't even lift a machine gun. Well, you could put a pistol or rifle in there, and that's supposedly where the 15-round magazines were used the most. How true that is and for how long they were used, I do not know. I do know that they do have the orders from a small one from the British, a larger one from the French, and a large one from the Russians for some of the rifles and untold thousands of rounds of ammunition. And I imagine that even in the Second World War, they were used somewhere, sometime. Somebody had, some leftovers of these World War I guns that were used at least during a brief period of time, maybe during the invasion of France, maybe during the invasion of the Soviet Union, who knows? Or maybe they were just given to plant guards or people who doing some sort of rear security type of operations. So it's pretty interesting. Okay, that brings us to a related question: Guns of the Highwaymen. Now, I've seen The Highwaymen a few times, Netflix movie starring Kevin Costner, Woody Harrelson. Very, very good. The guns were all there's one. There's one anachronism that I will point out, but used a lot of great guns. Started off, obviously the Colt single action army because these guys were former Texas Rangers, operating in that very early 1900s, and that was still considered a pretty first-rate defense gun, even though there were some more advanced designs out there around 1900. It goes from there to, probably my favorite scene in the movie where Kevin Costner as Frank Hamer, the legendary Texas Ranger, actually goes into a gun shop. And of course, he buys a Thompson, a Colt Monitor, a BAR, a Springfield with glass, meaning a sniper scope or a scope, I should say, and a 30-30 and a Smith & Wesson 1917. He's got a whole laundry list of firearms he buys, and they trundle all these things out to his car. The interesting part is he's looking in what would look to be a magazine or a catalog. And they do a brief flash to it, and the gun you see happens to be a World War II G43, a gun that not only would not have been for sale, but wasn't even designed yet in 1934. So that's a pretty funny anachronism that's there. Plus, I don't think there were any gun magazines that would have been in color in the early to mid-1930s. The only ones I've ever seen are the American Rifleman or its precursor. I forget what it's called, and they're strictly black and white. The cover was kind of yellow, had this kind of goldish yellow border on the cover, but all the pictures were black and white, so I don't think the color covers really would have existed the way we see it. But anyway, they do a very, very good job, and the shotguns, the short-barreled Remington shotguns, semi-automatic. There were some pump shotguns in there, and a few other things. Definitely spot on, as near as I could tell. Now, again, as the movie gets older and people with really sharp eyes watch it, they may see more inaccuracies or anachronisms. But you definitely go there and You definitely watch it, and it's very entertaining. They do one thing, though. I'm pretty sure they did this. When you hear the Thompson in the very beginning, and it's kind of a signal for a jailbreak, I'm sure they enhanced the noise on that. So because they do that with the Thompson, and it makes it, sound as ferocious as it looks. So it's a really a very very entertaining movie, though. Very well done. If you love the cars, you love the clothes, you love the story, I like all that. So therefore it's a good deal. As a quick aside to that, if you do like that era, it appears that the first precinct of the American Zoot Shooters Association is holding matches. They do it up in the hills in Colorado. I don't know exactly where, but at least it's got some life to it. I think there is not going to be the big 3-day shoot this year that they normally have, that they bill as the world championships or national championships. I don't think that's going to happen, but it really does look like this other club is doing at least monthly matches, which is a great thing. And I wish I could generate some of that in my area, so we'll see how that goes. Maybe, we'll try something. Okay, and I think the last question we have here is, can you explain the lure of the retro AR? Here we are. We actually did a whole podcast, it seemed like, just a few days ago on the ARs, but specifically the retro AR. Why do people find that interesting? Why are people building it? Why is a company like Brownells heavily invested in it? What's the deal? Because by all rights, the retro AR should have died in 1982 when Colt stopped making the SP1 and the SP1 carbine. They stopped making those and moved on to their more advanced models, which were, essentially A2 based, M16 A2 based, or AR-15 A2 based. And then they went to M4 based, now M16 A4 based. So they've kind of gone very much along with the modernization. So why look back? Well, I think there's a big reason. First of all, Colt kind of dabbled in it, and it's yet another market they've blown. They brought out a Colt, M16A1 semi-auto a few years ago, and it was horrifically priced. I mean, I think it was, I'm just guessing here, going off my memory, but I believe it was $2,600. A lot of money, but it's a genuine Colt, and it's marked Colt, and it's it is what it is. I mean, it's probably as close to the original without the full auto that you can get. So very, very good on them. They produced it. Some people bought it, had to have a Colt, and that's it. And that's strictly a nostalgia piece. Hate to admit it, but our Vietnam veterans are starting to get up there now, and they're for the most part retired from whatever jobs they've had. They've reached retirement age, and there's nostalgia to shoot the gun that, now that you got time and you've got some disposable income, kids are all grown out of the house, grandkids are probably almost grown. There's a nostalgia for the rifle you shot 40, no, more than 40, 50 years ago in the rice paddies in a faraway place. There's a lot of nostalgia for something like that, and the Colt filled all that at the kind of the higher end part of the market. Intrepid builders have been able to build clones of the M16A1, clones of the earlier M16s, clones of the CAR-15, the XM177E1. They've been able to do that with kind of some of the lowers and things that are out there now. Were out there then, I should say. But this all really started to take off. Brownells recognized people wanted that, definitely wanted that early AR-15 feel, look, and performance. And they introduced, at first it started with just a couple of rifles, and now it's expanded into, I think, almost every variant of the 5.56 AR-15 from the very first prototype to the last one before the A2 is represented in their line. And for about $1,000 plus a rifle, you could put together a collection of the Brownells rifles and have a very representative collection of U.S. military early M16 rifles, and kind of go from there. You could still find, kind of modern A2. It's harder to find fixed carry handle guns anymore, but and you could then add an A2 and then go add the modern ones. But you could put together with Brownells, get that base collection of guns that are for the most part unobtainable. Even if you can find one, it's going to be an original. It's going to be Class 3 because of the full auto feature. And face it, there wasn't that much variety in the SP1. It kind of looks like the original M16, and it has no forward assist. And the carbine is the same way. They just built it that way. They didn't think civilian shooters needed the forward assist, and they weren't trying to make it look like an M16A1. So, you can get the original SP1s, but then you really don't have much variety. Whereas the ones Brownell makes, Brownells makes, they're very, very authentic. The fencing is right. The contours are right. The colors are right. Everything on them is right. And I just examined a AR Proto, the first one. And I can tell you it's as good. You know what? I will even say this. It is probably better quality than a Colt SP1. If you had a brand new Colt SP1, which I had way back in the day, the Colt, it was not uncommon for them to come with the upper and lower receivers slightly mismatched in color. Not real bad. They were both kind of that gray Parkerizing, if you will. They're kind of that green-gray Parkerizing, but the shades would definitely be different because they didn't do the whole gun at once. They did the uppers in one place, lowers in another, and put them together and said, "Hey, this is what it is." So, it's the Brownells one, I will say, completely matches. It's just as tight. It's when I was field stripping this one and looking it over, it reminded me of the time so many years ago when I basically was taking apart the SP1 for the first couple of times. It brought me right back to that nostalgia point, and I'm like, whoa, this is really something. And they've got the same kind of particle inspecting, the MP8 and all the rest of it, chrome bore, chrome chamber. It is at least as good as the SP1. And I would say that in some areas it's actually better. So you're buying a better gun, and sometimes they put them on sale for very attractive prices. Now that scares me because if they're not going to be popular, they're not going to keep making them. So if you want one, I would strongly suggest you scoop it up now. I would say go after the Retro AR by Brownells, the one you want right now. Don't wait to try to pick it up on the secondary market, because if they quit making it, everybody will want it. That's the way the gun market works. When something is discontinued, everybody wants it. And if you want proof of that, remember around 2004, 2005, the modern Armalite company came out with kind of a retro trigger charging handle AR-10, looked like an M16A2 with a trigger handle, and was in 7.62 NATO. Well, they proved to be not very popular. People thought they were kind of cool, but nobody really went after it. They didn't sell that many of them, and then they discontinued it. Now, guess what? They sell for more money. They went way up in price. Now, the new Brownells AR-10 is probably forced a price correction on those. But, before that came out, before anybody knew, all of a sudden that baby was up there in price, selling for twice of what you could have bought it for just a few years before. So if you really want one and you're on the fence, I would snap it up, and you could wait for one of their sales, and they do have some great sales now and again. But you know, in the long haul, it doesn't matter. If it doubles in value, which it could, $200 in the initial price tag is going to be basically pretty inconsequential. So I'd definitely snap one up. You know, what is the real, outside of collecting, outside of wanting just to shoot the kind of gun that was being fired 50 years ago or 60 years ago, what is the practicality of these? And I would say for your average civilian shooter, these are absolutely great guns. And here's the reason why. A lot of people, and I'm one of them, I don't want gadgets. I don't want to fumble with gadgets. I don't want, you know, the free float tubes with the funny looking holes and M-locks and rails. And, you know, I don't really need a gun where I'm hanging all this crud on it, lights, lasers, and all the rest. If I want that, there's modern rifles I can buy. But there are times when you want simplicity, sleekness, lightweight, and you know, a gun that is very, very good at a lot of things, and maybe not great at any one thing, but very good at a lot of different things. My opinion is the gamer guns, the ones that have the trick sights, all the trick equipment on them, they're very good for their specific purpose, their specific competition use. But there's a time when you want something a little more general, and that's going to be an accurate rifle that's got iron sights that can hit out to 300 yards, and you have that simplicity. And one thing I will say about AR-15 A1 sights is that they do not go out of adjustment. They just don't. When you sight them in and click them in and do your elevation on the front post and your windage on the rear, they stay there. And so they're very, very reliable that way. And it's not like the 1 to 10 power gamer scope that, hey, guess what? You got it on 10 power. Well, in the real world, if you're confronted with a target 15 yards away, you just sort of, you know, shoot over the top of the scope and hope you hit something. No, you still have functional iron sights, and you can hit from 0 to 300. Is it going to be as nice as shooting through one of those scopes? Can you get the magnification and all that? No, but you can hit the target. They work, and they work well. Which is why, you know, you don't see, you look at a lot of militaries throughout the world, and only the most affluent ones are using optical sights. Everybody else is still using the irons, because the irons work. You know, an EOTech is a great scope, or great, it's not really a scope, it's really an aiming device that gives you a great aiming reticle with zero magnification, and you can get the magnifier that pumps it up to like 3 power and all that. There are times you don't have time to fool with that. You don't have time to fool with it when you're confronted by a target that's very close, because they can cover the ground while you're trying to get your 3 power magnifier out of the way and then bring the rifle up, or try to do that simultaneously. The person can be on you. Bad guy can be on you. Iron sights give you that ability. Even if you just shoot over the top of them, you can have a much quicker reaction. Same thing, a lot of people looking for, you know, they turn on their laser and they're looking for the dot. Well, if they just went ahead and engaged with iron sights, they'd probably hit their target a lot faster and get the result they're looking for. So the sleekness, the lightweight, and the simplicity of retro ARs really make them a very, very attractive alternative to the high dollar, you know, overly complex guns that we kind of see coming out now, and where everybody's hanging a goodie on the front. And, you know, I've used M4s. I've had vertical hand grips on them and all that, you know, and some of that stuff works just great. But the simplistic stuff works great too. And the lightweight is something you appreciate when you have to grab something, manipulate it quickly, bring it up. Lightweight is great. So that's a lot of the attraction of these ARs. And, you know, InRange TV has done a good job covering some of these guns, and they've even used some in competition. And, you know, their analysis has been that although it's not as sophisticated, it is very effective. And if you can get something that's 95% as effective, but is a lot simpler, a lot lighter, and a lot more trouble-free, I think you've got a winning combination there. And that's why the Retro AR is still very, very popular. If I were Brownells, I probably would have made one change. Now, I understand why they did not, and I agree with them for not doing it. But I would have liked to have their Retro AR barrels in 1 and 8, or possibly 1 and 9, but I think 1 and 8 would have been better. That way you can stabilize all projectiles. Nobody can see the rifling twist rate from the outside of the gun. You know, it's something that's invisible. The only difference anybody would ever know is that you can shoot 75 grain bullets through there and they're stabilizing. So that'd be the only way people could tell that you had the faster twist rate. And I think most shooters would have appreciated that and would have thought that is basically giving in to some touch of modern that would really help the gun and make the gun a little bit more versatile for its owners. Not that there's anything wrong with just shooting 55 grain bullets. And I think they might have been roundly criticized. People would have said, well, this is a really good copy, but, you know, it has the wrong twist rate. I kind of get that. So I'm glad that they kept the 1 in 12, but I would have personally preferred something tighter. And actually, even on the original Proto AR, they could have gone with 1 in 14, which is what that was. But I think 1 in 12 was a much better choice. So, you know, it's a great rifle, and it's definitely set up in a way that makes it very, very useful, even today. And you kind of look at the price, and it's really funny. If you can find it on sale for $1,000, that's $1,000 of today's money. Back in the late 70s, the SP1 was selling for about $250 to, I think, about $290 tops. So by the time you adjust for inflation and all the rest of it, the Brownells gun is still kind of right in there. It's still right in there. So it's not outrageously priced. It's certainly not $2,600. It's certainly not the $3,000 that a custom builder would charge for you. And the gun is, you know, really excellent quality and give you years of service. But that's why I think there's a lure of the ARs. It's historical nostalgia. That's in one basket. But there's a very practical use for a lightweight, hard-hitting, simple and effective rifle that has the all the advantages of an AR, with manual of arms, the controls, and ARs really do have a decent trigger for a military rifle. Some people will criticize it, but it's really the out-of-the-box military trigger is fine, and you can do some really good work with that. It's a very, very appealing package to somebody who wants a very practical, simple, and lightweight rifle. Well, that's it for this edition of Old School Guns. As always, push the follower button and you can get notification when the next episode posts. Remember, we are beholden to no one. We have no sponsors. And so we tell it to you like it is. And we do appreciate you listening and hope you tune in again for further episodes. This is Old School Guns, out.